From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
The GOP and the lessons of last year's election. Hello again, I'm Warren Olney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. Barack Obama's second victory showed Republicans that the nation is changing, and that's led to an agonizing reappraisal. They're agreed on the need to reach out to Hispanics, women, blacks, and Asians, but they're divided on how that should be done. Rethinking core policies could alienate one or more party factions. Rewriting election rules could look like rigging the system. Will the emphasis change on immigration, big business, foreign policy, or social issues? Will they look to the states rather than Washington? On Reporter's Notebook later on, poor sleep, memory loss, and help for the aging brain. First the news.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Warren Olney, back with To the Point. In the aftermath of Barack Obama's re-election, Republicans are a divided party, but they know it's time for a change. Will outreach to new demographic groups mean alienating the base on core issues? Will they use their control over some 30 states to set new policies or rewrite the rules for presidential elections? On Reporter's Notebook, poor sleep may be the key to memory loss in older people, and the problem may be treatable. We'll hear about some new research. First, this news update. Yesterday, President Mohamed Morsi declared a state of emergency and a curfew in three major Egyptian cities. But protests that began on Friday are still continuing. Tarek El-Tablawi is Cairo Bureau Chief for Bloomberg News. Thank you very much for joining our program.
No problem. Thank you.
There have been 50 casualties, I take it.
Over the last... since the 25th of January anniversary celebrations, we've had probably a little over 50 now, with the toll kind of climbing incrementally, just largely predicated on the protests that started because of that really mushroomed in Port Said on the 26th.
And that had to do with the sentencing of people involved in a soccer riot, is that right?
Yeah, exactly. There was a court verdict which sentenced 21 people to death for their role in the Port Said soccer stadium riot on last February. It was a match between Wehli and Al-Masri teams. And essentially, there's still other people waiting verdict, but, the ones that were sentenced here were essentially fans or people from Port Said. And by and large, they feel like they've been scapegoated, that this was... a lot of other people are blamed for this tragedy. There was about 70 people that were killed in the soccer riots, and I feel that there's a lot of other people that really should have been held accountable and that they were just scapegoated in this.
What's going on now, though, seems to have escalated well beyond the protest over the soccer riot and actually questioned the legitimacy of the Morsi regime.
Well, it's been building. I mean, it's really kind of been building since day one when he was elected and took office at the end of June. There's been growing rifts between the Islamists and the secularists in the country. The secularists are largely skeptical or suspicious of Morsi's motives and essentially believe that he's looking to bolster the Muslim Brotherhood's monopoly on power. He's countered by arguing that a lot of the trouble that's been going on in the country has really been kind of the product of counter-revolutionaries or Mubarak regime loyalists who are intent on pretty much sowing discontent and undercutting the goals of the revolution. And as he's defined them, those are things along the lines of social justice, greater equity or equitable treatment for everybody in the country, and ideally a push towards a clear path towards democracy.
But now, with the curfew and with the state of emergency, he's being accused of using the same tactics that Mubarak used to quell protest.
It is. I mean, it's kind of ironic because certainly, we saw the same kind of curfew measures in place in the waning days of the Mubarak regime. And then the ruling military council that took over after after Mubarak was pushed from power towards the end of their tenure also looked to kind of cement their power in part by issuing a decree, I think it was around the middle of last June, where they basically gave themselves the right, or gave the military, police, and intelligence the right to arrest civilians. And now there's, the cabinet is passed on to the parliament's upper house, which now acts as essentially the whole parliament. A draft law that would give the military the right to operate in tandem with the security force to ensure security, and part of that is also arresting civilians.
What about the police, and what's their behavior like? Are they arresting a lot of people now and using that power?
It's really kind of a mixed bag. I mean, part of a lot of what's been fueling the discontent over the last few months has been, and then certainly even before Morsi's election, has been the complaint that the police have been absent from the nation. I mean, from within the first few days of the uprising in 2011, the police withdrew, and they really haven't reasserted their presence. I mean, we're talking about an institution that was one of the most feared and reviled, under Mubarak, but after the so-called wall of fear was broken, in January 2011, they lost a lot of the clout that they had. I mean, people just now are intolerant, and you've had situations where I think the average Egyptian will tell you the police are afraid to kind of step in because they know that whatever they end up doing is going to be interpreted as a reversion back to those, somewhat draconian methods that were in place under Mubarak.
And very quickly, we only have about 30 seconds left. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but what about the army? You mentioned the military council earlier. It's been changed. Has the army taken sides now?
The Army's been really very careful about coming out repeatedly, and especially over the last couple of months. They're trying to maintain a very kind of neutral stance in all of this, and basically saying that we're neither this way or that way. What we are is a representative of the Egyptian people. And, going back to the old mantra that they had from over a year ago, the people in the Army are okay. Hand in hand.
All right, Tarek El-Tablawi in Cairo for Bloomberg News. Many thanks to you. In a moment, the GOP and the lessons of last year's elections. Now, to the point.
Make a donation of just a dollar a day, and you can join one of our exciting and exclusive Angel Clubs. Choose from music, books, DVDs, or cookbooks delivered right to your front door. Learn more and join now at kcrw.com/join.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
Warren Olney back with To the Point. In his second inaugural address, President Obama didn't say much about bipartisanship. He did lay out a progressive vision based on demographic change and ultimately electoral realignment. House Speaker John Boehner saw it this way.
And so we're expecting here over the next 22 months to be the focus of this administration as they attempt to annihilate the Republican Party. And let me just tell you, I do believe that is their goal, to just shove us into the dustbin of history.
John Boehner speaking to a group of Republicans after the president's inaugural address. The Republican National Committee is not taking Obama's victory lightly, of course. At last week's annual meeting, Louisiana Governor Bobby Jindal had this to say.
The Republican Party does not need to change our principles. But we might need to change just about everything else we are doing.
Jeff Zeleny is national political correspondent for the New York Times. He was there at the convention in Charlotte, North Carolina. Good to have you with us.
Good afternoon.
So they're not going to change the principles. What are they going to change?
Well, I think one of the things that most Republican leaders, members of the National Committee, and just other party leaders across the country and in Washington believe that the party needs to change some of its how it sounds to people. A tone, if you will. Specifically Governor Jindal there was talking about Republican primaries have really set the party back in terms of their abilities to try and win control of the Senate. In the 2010 cycle as well as the 2012 cycle, there were Republicans who won primary challenges who were not able to win the general election in the fall because they were not sort of able to appeal to a wide stream, mainstream voters, if you will. So that is what Republican leaders think they need to sort of change. Just look more inclusive, look a little bit more welcoming, and stop focusing on some of the issues that are more divisive. But at the same time, uphold the principles, you know, of being opposed to abortion rights, et cetera. So it's a fine line here to a walk, but they're trying to get started on that path.
Some of those primary candidates that you mentioned who lost to Democrats in the general elections had defeated incumbent Republicans or driven them out due to fear of loss in the primaries.
No question. I think, you know, there are several examples of this. The most recent, I guess, probably highest profile example last year was Senator Richard Lugar of Indiana. He decided to run for re-election. He was defeated in the Republican primary. And then his challenger, Richard Murdoch, went on to lose the general election seat. So a Democrat now is in that seat. So Republicans know that that their path to winning the Republican majority in the Senate is a contingent on winning six seats, picking up six more seats. And they are really trying to get more of a handle around these primary challenges coming forward. We're seeing a lot of retirements already in the Senate. We'll see how they do with that, though. It's very difficult to control primary challenges. It's not as easy as it used to be when there's sort of more of a top-down system. Someone would, you know, say that it's your turn to a run and would get these other people out of there. But it's been difficult for the party to control these primary challenges. We'll see if they're better at it this year.
Well, was it just a matter of tone during the primaries, or was it also a question of what issues were emphasized and the way that they were, I guess the way they were addressed has to do with the tone. But when people were talking about legitimate rape, for example, that's certainly one of the things that caused them to go down to defeat.
It is. And that's exactly the instance that Governor Bobby Jindal was mentioning. I mean, he believes that the Republican Party, in his words, should not be a stupid party, and he was referencing those specific words like a legitimate rape and other things. But one of the things, sir, I think that's been kind of missed, the Democratic Party and Democrats were playing in the Republican primary. They were trying to defeat the other more mainstream Republican candidates through ads and other things, and that's how some of these Republican primaries were decided. Some of the weaker opponents ended up winning. So the primaries, in many respects, are always at least as interesting, perhaps more interesting than the general election. And I think we'll probably see that again in this 2014 cycle. We're already seeing several retirements over the weekend. Senator Tom Harkin from Iowa announced that he is going to retire after serving a five terms. There's already a free-for-all going on among Republicans. Who's going to run for this? We'll see what type of candidate emerges, and that will play a role, a big role, in answering the question of if Republicans can win the Senate or not.
Tom Harkin, a Democrat in a state, Iowa, which could be Republican territory. What about substance, though? Have they suggested in any way, they say they'll keep their principles. What does that mean? And are there issues, are there questions of policy that they also want to amend, or are they not doing that?
Well, I think we'll find an early look at this through immigration reform. We're seeing a bipartisan group right now on Capitol Hill, four Democratic senators, four Republican senators, and they seem to be getting some type of a deal in the works. If that would happen to go forward, and if immigration reform of some kind would become reality, I think that would help the party a lot in terms of how it looks, in terms of how it reaches out to other voters, et cetera. So immigration reform is an early test of that. You know, some of the other social issues in 2014 might still be divisive issues, gay marriage and other things, but a lot of Republican leaders are not interested in those dominating the debate. But immigration reform, I think, will be an early look into how successful the party can be.
Jeff Zeleny, again, national political correspondent for The New York Times. Whit Ayers is president of North Star Opinion Research. That's a Republican polling firm based in Alexandria, Virginia. His clients include Senators Lamar Alexander of Tennessee, Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, Bob Corker of Tennessee, Marco Rubio of Florida. He also represents the governor of Tennessee, Bill Haslam. Good to have you, Whit Ayers, on our program.
Warren, good to be with you.
Is this enough just to change the tone? Or if they're going to reach out to Hispanics, as well, and not to mention the blacks and Asians and women in particular, are they going to have to change policies as well?
Warren, we're undergoing a review of that question right now. It's amazing how a loss focuses the mind and opens one up to new ideas that one might not have considered before. Jeff mentioned immigration, and I think that's the first up on the table. You mentioned our client Marco Rubio and Lindsey Graham are two of the eight senators who have been involved with putting forth a statement of principles on how we move forward with immigration reform. They have been real leaders on this issue, and I think the party is very open to some new ideas and some new policy positions on immigration, so that I think you will see the party changing not only its tone, but also some positions on critical issues.
They are beginning announcing their principles today, and there's going to be more on that tomorrow as well. How far are they willing to go on the path to citizenship, which is for illegal immigrants here in this country, which is called amnesty by so many Republicans?
One of the principles of the plan that they are going to propose is that those who are in the country without documentation be allowed to enter into a legal status which stops short of actual citizenship. Then once they are legal, after they meet certain requirements for being legal, then they can apply for citizenship just like anyone else. But one of the principles that Senator Rubio has been very adamant about is that they should not be allowed to jump to the head of the line ahead of other people who have been following the process legally. And so that could be a point of contention. But it only seems fair that you allow the people who have been following the process legally to come first before those who have followed a process without documentation.
Well, the senators that you represent are all in conservative southern states, and many of them some people in the Republican Party, at least, are saying that in order to win a presidential election, you've got to get more than the southern states, and you have to appeal to urbanites and suburbanites as well in some of the blue states. Are the Republicans going to make changes in policies that will appeal to those people?
Well, of course. I mean, there's no question you can't win the presidency with support in only one or two regions of the country. The big treasure trove of electoral votes is in the upper Midwest, in states like Wisconsin and Michigan and Pennsylvania and Ohio. Republicans have demonstrated an ability to win major races in all of those states, governor and Senate races. So it's very clear Republicans can be competitive in those states. Now we need a presidential candidate who can also be competitive there.
So what are some of the new ideas then? Does this include, for example, changing the way in which electoral college votes are distributed?
I don't think so. I think that's the kind of thing that comes back to bite you in the long run. There's some folks playing with that idea, but I doubt that will get very far.
Okay, we won't go further with that then. What about the changes in policy that might affect people in the upper Midwest? Do you see anything specifically there, particularly that would get people who voted Democratic to change their minds and vote Republican?
Well, I think that it's a whole combination of a different tone, a different attitude of outreach and inclusion, and a few, not a great many, but a few key policy changes like those we've just discussed on immigration reform. In the hands of a very gifted campaigner, you can present a very, very different image and a very different brand of the Republican Party in 2016 than we have seen in the immediate past, and I'm confident that will happen. It's amazing, Warren, if you compare the role or the plight of Republicans today with that of the Democrats in 1989. Democrats had just lost five of the six previous presidential elections in the popular vote, similar to the situation Republicans find themselves in today. And it looked hopeless for the Democrats. It looked like Republicans had a lock on the Electoral College. Along comes Bill Clinton, talks about being for the death penalty, ending welfare as we know it, and 3 years later, he walks into the Oval Office. So these things can turn around very, very quickly in the hands of a gifted politician.
Whit Ayers, again, president of North Star Opinion Research, represents to many Republicans at the state level. Luis Alvarado is a Republican political consultant. He's based in Los Angeles. In the past, he's worked on campaigns for Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush. Most recently, served as the Los Angeles regional chair for the McCain-Palin campaign. Luis Alvarado, good to have you on our program.
Thanks for the invitation. I also work with Romney and gubernatorial races, but we're here in the front line. Thanks for the invitation.
Okay. Would it be enough in blue states, I don't know if California should be named as one where this would be possible or not, to do what Whit Ayers has suggested and nothing more, change campaign strategy, change the position on immigration, and try to control your language?
Well, that's one of the building blocks that we need to make sure that it's enforced. But you also have to look at the whole perspective of other issues that in the political landscape. You know, at the end of the day, we still have a deficit problem. We still have a fiscal crisis that we haven't overcome yet. And the question is, how does the policies that the Republicans present actually fit into the problems that the general population face on a day-to-day basis?
Well, what new policies might be suggested in the area of deficit of the deficit and the fiscal crisis that look different and sound different from the ones we heard in 2012?
Well, you know, we're talking about immigration reform being presented recently, and that's one key step because we're not just looking at the social issues or what the political implications of actually supporting an immigration reform has for the political parties, but also the economical impact that this move will create in helping the economy move forward. We're creating a whole different classification of workers, and how they actually contribute to the country is very important to recognize. That's one of the reasons why the U.S. Chamber of Commerce has now changed their position in support of having immigration reform that would be viable to the interest of the country from an economical standpoint.
So what about other issues such as the social issues, for example, which are anathema to many Democrats, particularly those who want to stress the right to abortion, a woman's right to choose, and contraception as well? Do Republicans need to change their tune on that?
I think Republicans have to change their tune on everything that they have. I mean, I was in the room with Bobby Jindal, made that speech, and to be honest with you, the Republican committee members received it very well. They understand that the political playbook we've used up until now is no longer a viable one.
But he didn't talk about, excuse me for interrupting you, but he didn't talk about any specific policy changes, only about changing tone.
Well, I think when you can't change tone without actually making corrections on how you present your policy. And I think that's what our opening is as Republicans, to ensure that we are in touch with a mainstream voter and understanding what their challenges are and without letting go the principles of what the party represents. But the party represents interest, in my opinion, at times has been hijacked by splinter groups in the Republican Party, and they seem to be the ones that getting all the attention, when in reality there are many mainstream Republicans who don't share some of those values. And I think the party...
I'm going to interrupt you in the interest of time. We need to go to a break. We will come back, let you continue your point. We'll talk more with Whit Ayers and others about how the Republicans are trying to reassess their situation. On Reporter's Notebook later, poor sleep, memory loss, and possibly help for the aging brain. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
We're only back with To the Point. President Obama's re-election took a lot of Republicans by surprise. We're taking a look at the elections, the lessons that they have learned or not learned from the last election. They say that they want to make big change, that they have to make big change, and we are trying to determine exactly what that means. Luis Alvarado, a Republican political consultant in Los Angeles, just said it means making real changes in policy, I take it. You're saying they've got to get more into the mainstream and deal with splinter groups that have hijacked the party. Who are you talking about?
Well, you know, it's the Tea Party is one of them. And I think the Tea Party, to a certain degree, also has received a bad rap because initially the Tea Party was a reflection of the policies of the drastic change to the left that the White House had enacted. And certainly that was the initial intent. And I think there were splinter groups within the Tea Party that also hijacked the Tea Party and made it a social issue organization. I think now we've realized that, you know, the social issues do not fit in the national conversation to a degree. We need to ensure that the Republican brand represents all the Americans with respect to the initial principles of the Republican Party, and we cannot expend so much energy and resources in promoting only a singularity of issues that are prominent to small regions of the country. I think we need to start looking at the Republican idealism as a national tool that helps the country move forward. And I think that is the message that we're starting to understand. And I think that's the message that's going to help us separate from those small splinter groups that have taken at least the spotlight.
Luis Alvarado in Los Angeles, Republican political consultant. Back to Whit Ayers, our president of North Star Opinion Research, representing so many Republicans in the South. Does that sound like a recipe for the kind of primaries we heard about earlier, where Tea Partiers and others get together and go after a moderate or relatively moderate Republican and knock them off?
Well, perhaps there will certainly be intense primaries on the Republican side as well as on the Democratic side. But what we're talking about is electing people who speak for the broad mainstream of the Republican Party, who can carry that message effectively into a general election. There's a heightened awareness of the need to do that now in light of recent senatorial losses, and I think you will see the party do that. One thing that American political parties do very well is adapt to changing circumstances after they lose, and Republicans will adapt and will be far more competitive than their Democratic opponents would wish for, I suspect. Very quickly.
Well, but in the states where you have candidates in and office holders in Virginia, in Tennessee, in South Carolina, Florida, is it possible to downplay the social issues? And if you do, might that be a recipe for defeat?
It is possible to reframe the fundamental argument without changing your fundamental principles. And I think a gifted candidate will be able to do that and will be able to sell that to a majority of the country.
Okay. And Luis Alvarado, how do you feel about that? You have to make substantive change?
I couldn't agree more with that statement. The reality is in primaries, you know, I think the party itself has lost a little bit of their ability to influence, and I think the splinter groups have had more power in selecting the candidates and how the tactics and the communication process that's utilized in this primaries is the one that's dominating the brand of the Republican Party. And I think if once we start finding candidates that actually represent mainstream America and still are true to their values of the Republican Party, they're going to be successful. I think the country and even the Republicans are starting to understand that this rhetoric, that red meat rhetoric, may help you in the primary, but it will not help you in the general, regardless if you're in the South or you're in Los Angeles.
Let's turn to Tim Alberta. He is a reporter for the National Journal. He's co-author of the latest cover story of that magazine. It's entitled "Road to Recovery: A 12-step program on how to get the grand old party back on track." Tim Alberta, it's good to hear from you.
Good to be with you.
You have a 12-step program laid out very specifically. Have the kinds of changes that Luis Alvarado and Whit Ayers have been talking about, do they meet what you think are the standards necessary for the kind of change that will win elections for Republicans?
Well, sure. I think it's a start. I think a lot of these issues, you have to remember, there are always going to be different factions within a political party. You know, Republicans, Democrats, they're not going to agree on everything. I think a lot of this, whether it's immigration or social issues or any number of other sensitive topics, at the end of the day, it speaks to the tolerance within a party, how accepting a party can be of differing views within its own party, and sort of a commitment to sort of agree to disagree on the smaller things while agreeing on the overarching vision moving forward. And I think that's what we haven't seen a whole lot of from Republicans in recent years. We've seen sort of a my way or the highway mentality, and I think that ultimately is the most harmful thing to the party moving forward.
Well, step three in your 12-step program is dealing with immigration. We've already heard about that, and that seems by virtue of demographic change to be a real requirement. What about step two, go outside your comfort zone? What's that mean?
Well, interestingly enough, when we spoke to so many Republicans for this story, we expected that immigration would be the first thing that we would hear about. And from some folks, it was. But from the majority of Republicans we spoke to, we heard first and foremost about the 47% remark and how that hurt the Republican brand. But it went much deeper than Mitt Romney just, you know, saying his off-the-cuff remark about how 47% of Republicans, or excuse me, of Americans would never vote for him. He sort of unwittingly legitimized this long-held notion that Republicans view a certain segment or certain segments of the American electorate as sort of off-limits and not worth their time. And whether those are single women, young voters, African-Americans, union members, welfare recipients. There are a lot of groups that the Republican Party has sort of just pushed to the side and said, you know what, they're not going to vote for us, so it's not worth our time to engage them in the first place. And for a party that has a base of white voters that is constantly comprising a shrinking slice of the electorate, that is no longer a sustainable strategy for the Republican Party.
Whit Ayers, do you agree with that?
Of course, and to the extent that that's true, I think you're going to see a very different approach from Republican leaders. Politics is about addition, not subtraction. And the best Republican leaders and some of the most conservative Republican leaders, like Ronald Reagan, were aggressively inclusive. He reached out to blue-collar Democrats, what we called at that point Reagan Democrats. He reached out to minorities. He reached out to people who didn't look like traditional Republicans and said, we want you as part of our team. We want you as a team that believes in freedom and opportunity and free enterprise and growing the economy and everybody getting ahead. And he was very successful in that, and I think you're going to see a lot of Republicans adopting that same tone.
Tim Alberta, back to you. Again, step six in your 12-step program. Many in the party, you say, believes that the GOP needs to divorce itself not just from big government, but also from big everything, business, oil, the military, the big banks. Tell us some more. Why do you think that's necessary, and how would that work in a Republican Party that depends for its campaign contributions on exactly those groups?
Well, we've heard from Republicans as well as some Democrats that there is sort of a new conventional wisdom that can be found sort of simmering beneath the surface of the American electorate, and that conventional wisdom is this, that no longer is the American system fair to the little guy, to the ordinary voter, the average citizen. So I think both parties, but especially the Republicans coming off this loss, and as Whit said, the party, anytime a party loses, it needs to sort of do a self-evaluation process and sort of adapt to its new environment and evolve. And I think Republicans have an opportunity to sort of frame themselves as sort of a leaner populist party that is out there to fight for the little guy and is sort of out there to help simplify life and sort of even the playing field. And I don't think that there should be any sacred cows. I think when you look at the bank bailout, for instance, I mean, that polled poorly across the political spectrum. And I think that is one instance of a case where Republicans could sort of stand up and say, listen, we're not beholden to anyone. We're not beholden to big oil, to big business, the big banks, whatever it may be. Big military. I think if the Republican Party were to sort of step back and sort of try to align itself, at least rhetorically, more with the average voter on Main Street than with the wealthy donor on Wall Street, I think in the long run that that would pay tremendous dividends for the party.
Whit Ayers, back to you, president of North Star Opinion Research. The Republicans have been trying to repeal or talking about repealing Dodd-Frank. They've been talking about, of course, no cuts in the military. They want business to be freed up from regulation. They want more oil drilling. Are they going to be able to turn away from those things?
They are going to reframe that as not looking at trillion-dollar deficits as far as the eye can see, not looking at entitlement programs that are on the road to bankruptcy, but trying to do something to preserve and protect them, and not trying to stop things like the Keystone Pipeline that will give us lots of affordable energy, which will get this economy going. The Democrats have no particular hold on this electorate, particularly when it comes to a growing economy, and the Republicans have a lot better answers out there that, if articulated well and framed beautifully, will be far more attractive than where the Democrats are leading us down the road to fiscal ruin.
Luis Alvarado, Republican political consultant based here in Los Angeles. What about that? And what about climate change? Can Republicans attract people from across the aisle if they are in favor of the Keystone Pipeline and other kinds of energy proposals that might lead to greater emissions into the atmosphere?
Most certainly, like my colleague just said, as long as you reframe the argument to ensure that there is a benefit to the mainstream America on how our policies are best for the country, that's the ticket for us to actually gain acceptance and being able to shed this big everything belief that America currently has. You know, at the end of the day, it's not just about the leaders. It's also about the machine, the establishment, and even the political consultants who utilize the formula to get a certain percent of the electorate just with a clear intent of winning their particular race. Unfortunately, that strategy may work in parts of the country, but it hurts and has shockwaves throughout the country. So if a campaign utilizes that red meat in Arkansas to get elected, that now is being broadcasted in Spanish language networks throughout the country. And Latinos see that as those are the people who represent the entire party. So I think Republicans need to recalibrate how they utilize their communication tools, and the party and the leaders are the ones that have to be there to defend that. You know, when we saw Senator Aiken make that very horrible statement, Republican leaders throughout the country stood up and denounced it. But when Sheriff Arpaio in Arizona makes a statement that is hurtful to the Latino community, I think our leaders have not been standing up high enough to denounce his statements, because they don't represent the interests of the party with Latino communities, for and that's an example of how we need to recalibrate how campaigns are utilized in regional areas, because now those have repercussions throughout the nation, and those are hurting campaigns elsewhere.
Let me go back to Tim Alberta with the 12-step program. And again, the 12-step program wasn't invented by Tim Alberta. This is a result of interviews with Republican lawmakers and consultants on how to get the grand old party back on track. I want to make that very clear. Step 10 is a really interesting one, it seems to me. Don't Go There is the title of it. You say the Republicans Party has a palatable isolationist strain overshadowed by the hawkish wing dominated by Senators McCain and Lindsey Graham. You say, fortunately for Republicans, though, the palatability of embracing the isolationist bloc dovetails with the current stated effort to cut spending. Tell us more about that and how that helps to resolve contradictions within the Republican Party.
Sure. Well, I think it certainly is interesting that we spoke to several Bush 43 White House veterans, and there is sort of a consensus that they had the foreign policy argument in their back pocket sort of until 06, 07, and that ever since then, there has sort of been a broad reframing of the interventionist appeal as it relates to your everyday voter ever since. And I think when you talk to Republicans, and as you just made clear, this program that we my co-author and I produced, this was the result of conversations with nearly three dozen Republicans, and a very surprising number of those Republicans on the record were willing to say, look, I voted for the Iraq invasion in 03. I voted for Afghanistan in 2001. I've never voted against a spending bill for the troops. But at the same time, after a decade plus overseas fighting these seemingly endless wars, are we at the point now where we should sort of at least do an internal examination of the wisdom of these sort of protracted conflicts that have no end in sight? And, oh, yeah, by the way, they sort of run contrary to our own principle, our core principle of fiscal conservatism and not running up this deficit any more than it already is. So I think you are sort of seeing that self-reflection simmering within the GOP right now. And certainly you do have the sort of graybeard interventionist class with your Senators McCain and Graham, who are going to be averse to any sort of changes within the party structure on how it approaches foreign policy in the Obama era over the next 4 years. But I think at least it's a discussion now, and there is sort of some open debate, and that's not something we saw as recently as a year or two ago. And so I think that alone sort of signifies a changing of the guard, if you will.
Whit Ayers, Lindsey Graham's one of your clients. How's this going to go down in South Carolina with all the military spending that goes on there and the importance of the military to the very image of America?
Well, it's one of the subjects that will be part of the great debate. But, Warren, let me just encourage your listeners to read Tim Alberta's 12-step program for the Republican Party in the National Journal. It was a very thoughtful piece, which reflects a lot of the current thinking that's going on in the Republican Party right now. And we would not have seen this after 2010, when the Republicans won back won so many seats in Congress. So I think this is exactly the kind of discussion that we are having now that's going to be so productive in the long run.
Tim Alberta, the 12-step program, of course, comes from Alcoholics Anonymous. Is there an implication here that the Republicans are addicted to something that they need to overcome?
Well, I think it's less the idea that Republicans are addicted to something, and it's much more the idea that Republicans have sort of been in denial of any sort of problem over the last decade. And I think that that's something that Witt, as well as many other influential and intelligent Republicans, have spoken to in the past and are speaking to now. And I think the one thing that struck my co-author and I, as we spoke with nearly three dozen top Republican officials and operatives and strategists and activists, was that there was almost uniformly at the top of the conversation when we would speak to them, there was almost uniformly an acknowledgement that, you know what, there is a problem. Something here is not right. We just lost our second consecutive presidential election, and no longer can we afford to sort of play this game where we say, no, well, it's just this one little thing, and if we tweak it there and change our policy here and tweak our rhetoric there, then we're going to be fine and we're in good shape. No, that there is sort of an existential crisis of sorts facing the Republican Party, and they are now at the crossroads where they can either continue denying that crisis or they can admit the problem and they can do something about it. So the idea of this sort of road to recovery piece in this 12-step rehabilitation program was sort of rooted in the idea that Republicans, after spending a long stretch in denial, are finally sort of sitting down for the intervention and are admitting that they have a problem. And that is, of course, the first and most important step in any kind of rehabilitation.
And the first thing in the 12-step program as well. Well, thank you all very much. We will see whether this means some substantive change in policy, if it means a compromising on principles that some of the factions in the Republican Party hold dear to themselves, or what else will come out of this agonizing reappraisal by the Republican Party. Thank you all. Tim Alberta with the National Journal, Luis Alvarado, a political consultant based in Los Angeles, Whit Ayers, a political consultant based in Virginia, and our earlier guest, Jeff Zeleny of the New York Times. Good to have all of you on our program. Thanks very much for joining us. People of a certain age, not to mention their friends and relations, know that memory loss is a fact of aging. Now there is new research showing that poor sleep may be the culprit and that treatment may be on the way. Back in a moment with To the Point.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
Foreman Olney back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. Wisdom may come with age, but so does the loss of sleep and the loss of memory. Now researchers believe that there is a connection and that deep sleep can be restored along with memory itself. Matthew Walker is a professor of psychology and neuroscience at UC Berkeley. His new study on sleep and memory loss and aging was published yesterday in the journal Nature Neuroscience. Professor, thank you very much for being on our program.
You're very welcome.
Explain as you will. This is obviously brain science. Explain to our lay audience what the connection is between deep sleep and memory and how you think you can improve it.
Yes. So we were fascinated by the possibility that these two factors that we know co-occur with aging, in other words, as we get old, our memory gets worse, but also as we get old, our sleep starts to deteriorate. We were interested to try and discover whether those two things are interrelated. And the reason is because we've known now for some years that in young people, sleep is especially beneficial for helping us essentially hit the save button on new memories that we've learned and transfer them into stable, long-term memories. And what we discovered was that in older adults, firstly, the deep sleep that is helpful for memory actually starts to deteriorate significantly. In fact, older adults had about 75% less deep quality sleep compared to young, healthy people in their 20s. And what we also found was that that deterioration in sleep was directly related to the impairment that older adults had in helping them save and retain those memories across a night of sleep. So I think it highlights the critical role of sleep and the unfortunate deterioration of that sleep as we get older regards to memory.
Now, they are directly related because of things that go on in the brain and what you refer to as slow brain waves. What do you mean?
Yes. So at night, we go through a variety of different stages of sleep, but one of those is a deep, non-rapid eye movement sleep called slow wave sleep. And this type of deep, dreamless sleep, this restorative sleep, has been known for some time to essentially cement and consolidate new memories and allow us to save that information long term. And it's exactly the same type of sleep that unfortunately deteriorates as we get older.
How can it be restored? How can you get older people to have that slow wave sleep?
Yeah, it's a very interesting question. For me, as I progress in my own age rapidly, I'm very interested in the question. We've known in young adults that you can actually artificially stimulate the depth of their sleep by electrically stimulating the brain. And this is not marked electrical stimulation. This is very minor electrical stimulation. But by boosting the size of those slow waves during sleep, you can actually almost double the amount of memory improvement that they get across a night. And so the question now is, can we apply this same type of technology in older adults? And by restoring their sleep, can we restore a degree of their memory?
Why would you not be able to do that?
Well, I don't know. And the question, it's a question mark now because research hasn't yet approached that question. But I think it's a very viable target. So my hope is that the answer is yes, we can do it.
It seems to me if you could discover this and patent it, you could be a very rich person. What are some of the kinds of things that older people don't remember, the new information that younger people do?
Yeah, classically, it's memory for basic facts. So, for example, if you meet someone today and they tell you their name and their occupation or their telephone number, and you come back tomorrow, it's not as though you don't necessarily remember meeting them. It's just that the details, the facts, the name, the telephone number, perhaps the details around where you met them, those are the things that seem to unfortunately dissolve more easily in the brain, as it were, and we forget them more easily as we get older. That's the type of memory that we're talking about.
Are we talking about length of time in sleep? Is that a factor, or is it the quality of the sleep that you're talking about?
What we're finding is that it's more so the quality of the sleep rather than the total quantity of sleep. And so it's the quality of the electrical brain waves that are happening during this deep type of sleep. That's the factor that seems to be promoting the retention of memory in young people and, unfortunately, the deterioration of memory in older people.
And when the stimulation occurs, are there any side effects?
There are no known side effects currently. People don't even feel it. They don't even know that they're having this electrical stimulation during sleep. So certainly it seems to be a non-invasive and viable treatment target.
So there are undoubtedly a lot of people listening to this program who are very interested in what you are doing. How long do you think it will take to determine whether or not what works with young people is going to work with old people too?
Well, these studies, they take a long time, and we have to do them carefully and scientifically, so they tend to take many months, if not several years to do. But hopefully we can accelerate that, and with funding, we'll be able to get the answers.
In addition to electrical stimulus, are there drugs that do the same thing?
There are some drugs that seem to increase this type of sleep, although it's not known exactly how naturalistic that increase actually is. And of course, we similarly don't know that with the electrical stimulation. There's also other things such as exercise. That seems to be something else that can help improve the quality of sleep in older adults. So all of these things are now options on the table, and we have to, with research, pick them apart in terms of a finger buffet and figure out which of those are most effective.
Are there people in other places that are doing the same kind of research? Is there a race to determine whether or not this could work?
I expect that lots of minds think alike, and I doubt that we're the only group that's investigating this. So ultimately, the good news is for the public that it will probably happen sooner rather than later because of that race.
And when we're talking aging, we're not talking people who are 80 or 90. We're talking about people that are 40 or 50, something like that?
Well, here in the study, we were looking at people in the 60s through into the 70s and even into the early 80s. So it was a range of people that we would consider in that retirement area. So certainly not very old people. And we actually don't know about this question in middle age.
And middle age being roughly what?
This is a very politically incorrect question for me to answer, I suspect. But my guess is that, you know, you could classify somewhere in the region of 40 to 60. We could look at that area and think about that as middle age range.
Okay, well, I understand.
I know.
Nobody wants to commit on that one, and we can certainly understand it. Matthew Walker, again, it's a pleasure to have you on our program. Thanks very much. Very interesting information. We're all delighted to hear it.
Thanks very much. Sleep well.
Professor of Psychology and Neuroscience at UC Berkeley, certainly looking to a good sleep tonight. Program produced today by Francis Anderton, Caitlin Schamberg, and Katie Cooper. Technical Director Mike Newport. I'm Orman Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.